This program is brought to you by PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. To learn more about this podcast, visit pli.edu/pro bono podcast.
Today, we are doing something special. We usually come into the podcast feed to tell true stories about pro bono. But today we're going to dissect fictional stories about pro bono. Even though the Oscars are over, I am still wandering around my house humming, "I'm Just Ken," and thinking about Ryan Gosling in a Barbie pink rhinestone tuxedo. I mean, the movies that we obsess over every March, they stay in the culture long after the award shows are over. And some of those movies, they are about pro bono lawyers. Welcome to Pursuing Justice, the Pro Bono Files, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. We are here to tell pro bono stories, stories that we hope inspire you to take your own pro bono legal work to the next level. I'm your host, Alicia Aiken. I've worked in civil rights, criminal defense, and civil legal aid, but now I'm a principal at the Danu Center for Strategic Advocacy and a faculty fellow at PLI. And I love getting to talk with volunteer lawyers and nonprofit legal projects around the country about the pro bono work that matters to them. I hope you enjoy these conversations as much as I do. We thought it would be fun to go down the rabbit hole with some fictional accounts of pro bono lawyers. We'll take a look back at how Hollywood has imagined pro bono in 6 films, spanning from the 1940s to the 2010s. And I'll be sharing my bucket of popcorn with my favorite movie buff slash lawyer, my husband. And we'll get opinionated about what the movies get right, what they get wrong, and how the issues they tackle relate to our experiences with pro bono. So my guest today is an expert in both of our topics, law for the public good and movies. So can you introduce yourself, tell us your name and what you do?
My name is John Whitcomb. I work for Monahan Law Group, which does mental health law and guardianship. My law career has been in legal services, where I met you, Lish. I also was in Equip for Equality, which is a state protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities in the state of Illinois for 15 years. I did pro bono work in law school in Vermont and in Chicago.
And since we are recording this on Valentine's Day and this year marks 25 years of being married, I just want to say I love you. And I'm very excited to have this conversation about the movies with you. What does Oscar Quest mean at our house?
We see every movie, or at least we try to, that has been nominated for an Oscar. And that includes costumes and film editing and sound and international features.
This quest to see every nomination is never easy. When we lived in rural Vermont, we'd sometimes fly to Chicago to catch movies. Before streaming, we'd get DVDs from a friend of a friend who was actually in the Academy. And once we had kids, well, forget it. We were not going to make it to that many movies. But John never gives up. During the pandemic, he'd ask me to watch an Oscar-nominated movie with him, and then I'd find out that he meant a Netflix DVD of something nominated in 2002. He'd kept his old list and figured he'd use the lockdown to catch up. It is very generous of you, actually, to take a break from your hour demanding movie-watching schedule in the month of February to watch some old films that were either nominated or snubbed in the past. But that show a vision of pro bono in the movies. And so as an intense movie buff, I don't know, do you have any like overarching, like big picture thoughts about how lawyering for the public good comes up in films?
I think social change and depictions in especially law films, right, are really about telling people the injustice in the world. And now there's different movies that do that, but law is unusually well suited for that. And so the idea that pro bono would go hand in hand with law movies and we would have that issue is talking about the injustices of our society in a way that somebody can root for one side or understand an issue that they normally wouldn't and get a perspective of what happens in a legal scenario that affects society as a whole.
It was interesting actually trying to curate a list for this because trying to distinguish between somebody who is a paid nonprofit lawyer, clients don't pay them, but they get a salary. And a lot of the big movie cases, like the environmental cases, are not pro bono cases. They are cases where the lawyer is only going to get paid if they win a civil action, Aaron Brockovich. And so it was interesting when we decided to do this to start trying to drill down to figure out what are the movies that actually lift up a lawyer representing a client for no pay. And we made one tiny exception that we'll talk about, and we'll talk about why. But it was interesting once you put that specific lens on it, what the movies said about why people volunteer and why they would do that and what their relationship is to the client. And I really like the list of movies that you came up with. So we've got six. Do you want to just tell folks real quick what are the six movies we're going to talk about?
The first movie we're going to get into is On the Basis of Sex, which is the Ruth Bader Ginsburg sort of docudrama. It was advertised as How She Found Her Voice, although she pushed back on that. The second one is To Kill a Mockingbird, which is the Gregory Peck Academy Award winning movie. The third is Just Mercy, which is Michael B. Jordan playing Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama. And then we're going to go from that, which both of those are capital cases, to My Cousin Vinny, which is a funny movie with Joe Pesci. And then we're going to go into my area of law, which we're going to do I Am Sam, which is a movie with Sean Penn playing an intellectually disabled person who is fighting for custody of his child. And then we're going to end with Miracle on 34th Street.
Which, as we always say in our house, is not a Christmas movie. It is a courtroom procedural.
It is actually Mental Health Court, which is a court that I appear in front of on a regular basis.
Movie number one, On the Basis of Sex, released in 2018. Starring Felicity Jones as a younger Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Armie Hammer as her husband, Marty Ginsburg. On the Basis of Sex, tell us a little bit about the context of On the Basis of Sex coming out and its relationship to the Oscars.
So On the Basis of Sex was one of two movies on Ruth Bader Ginsburg in that Oscar year. And the one was a documentary, which both of you and I saw, and that was nominated for two Oscars. And this was nominated for no Oscars. It was completely snubbed. Felicity Jones was rumored to be one of the top candidates for getting an Oscar for Best Actress, but she was snubbed. And it is a far superior film to RBG, which both of us hated.
I know. And I love documentaries. And I was so frustrated with RBG.
So it didn't talk about what she actually achieved. It talked about her as a cultural figure. And so there was obviously explanations of things that she did before the court, but it didn't have any historical perspective of why that was important. It did not do what I wanted it to do, which is sort of tell me who Ruth Bader Ginsburg was and how she became who she was. And this movie that, again, was not nominated for an Oscar, but we saw together, which I love.
Yeah.
On the Basis of Sex, I love for so many different reasons, mostly because there are two lawyers living together who are both successful, who work off of each other and are supportive of each other in the entire thing. And I was like, if I had to have a movie that we could step into, that this would be the movie. Not that either of us are like Marty or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but that their relationship is really great.
Okay, what's the pro bono connection specifically? Because my bet is that people, even folks who saw the film, might not quite remember how Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Marty Ginsburg were doing pro bono.
So it's set in 1970. This is before she's a Supreme Court justice. There's sort of a story about her unable to get a job, and she starts teaching at Rutgers, and she's teaching sex discrimination at Rutgers, which at that point, the movie sort of makes a point, does not exist. And so Marty brings her a tax case and said, you need to pay attention to it. And there's a guy who lives in Colorado, I think Charles Moritz is his name, and he was helping with his aging mother and needed to hire a caregiver when he was at work. And the law at that time, it's really hard to understand this, but the tax code at that time did not recognize that a single man could hire nursing care so that he could work. And I think if the movie's right, it was like a woman or a widow or a divorcee could do it, but a single man couldn't. And so Marty's like, this your case. And she looked at it and said, this is about a man. And he's like, exactly. So your judge is going to be men. Everybody's going to be men. You should do this. So she originally tried to get the ACLU to join in because they had some clout and they said no. And so she, as a professor at Rutgers, flew out to Denver, met with Charles Moritz, and that's the scene in the movie. And she said, I'd like to take your case. And Mr. Moritz tells Ruth, you know, I'm told this is a loser. And she said, no, we believe that you properly claimed the deduction and are willing to take your case for free. And there's a conversation where he says, why would you do that? And she says, because you're the beginning and other people will follow. And so that's the pro bono issue of it. So this is all about an appellate argument. And so she's willing to do the appeal for him, write the brief and all that work for free in order to do that. After she writes the brief, the ACLU ends up joining in. The interesting part about the movie is that Dorothy Kenyon, who I had heard of before and had forgot that she was actually in the movie, actually talked on her behalf. It's like, she wrote this brief, she sent it to me, you guys need to get on board with this because this is the case that it's going to change everything.
And that is a thing that I think most people, even most lawyers, you probably didn't spend much time on sex discrimination in constitutional law, especially if you're going to law school now. You know, we got gender equality by saying it hurts men. I mean, there's a bunch of cases like young men in Oklahoma couldn't buy 3.2 beer, but young women could.
I think that's the sort of kicker of the movie. The women's rights movement in general was coming. You know, you see the protests outside for gender equality, and then they figure out that the way that they're going to get it through the courts is to claim gender equality on the basis of men, because everybody sitting on the benches look like me. They're white, male, and, you know, old.
They do look an awful lot like you.
The thing about on the basis of sex, which I like the most, is actually the moot section. And so there's a scene of Ruth Bader Ginsburg being mooted where she is going straight at the issue. And so she has a panel of other law professors and discrimination attorneys, including the head of the ACLU, who are mooting her. And a moot is when you ask questions like you are a judge. It's like a practice round for that. And she's getting hammered because she is like wanting to change everything in one fell swoop. And it is so obvious to her that what should happen that she can't really focus in on how the argument should go is what the film depicts.
Right.
And so I have had that where, so when I was at Equip for Equality, I represented a woman whose aunt, she was had a guardian because she had a traumatic brain injury. And so her aunt wanted her to be involuntarily sterilized. It seemed so obvious to me that this should not happen. And she understood what the procedure was, and she was telling people that she didn't want to have the sterilization done. So in order for my practice round on this, we brought in the best attorneys that I knew, and they all mooted me. And the first time I went through it, I was like, it's so obvious to me that she's saying no, that this shouldn't happen. And then they started asking questions, what if questions. And I was just like going through them very black and white, not being able to nuance it at all. And I was getting hammered. So I reworked my entire argument, and my argument was significantly better before the appellate court after that. But it's the first time I actually saw in a film a moot, because I know the story was Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually finding her voice. So the whole idea was that she didn't have her voice until she actually appeared before the appellate court in Moritz.
Which, can we say, is a little ridiculous? She was number one in her class at Harvard.
Right. So
she had a voice.
I agree with that almost entirely. And the person most importantly who agrees with that is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She admitted that the moot did not go well, which is, as she points out, is the purpose of a moot. She pointed out that the beginning of her argument in the film has her not being good, and then her rebuttal shows her all of a sudden doing this incredibly great argument. And her issue, I think, is that she was responding to questions from the justices in the beginning, so she couldn't actually articulate her overall theory, and the rebuttal allowed her to do that. And so the idea that she was somehow inept at the initial argument, which they clearly make the point in the film, was incorrect.
So the thing about the moot that's interesting, and I agree with you, it's the first time I've ever seen a moot in a movie, maybe any TV show, anything. But remember, the moot, so technically she and her husband Marty are co-counseling because he's a tax lawyer and he's in a big firm. And his big firm says they're not happy, but they agree to let him do the pro bono. And then they're doing the moot together, or she's doing the moot. He's sitting next to her. She's getting hammered. He leans over and gives her advice. And the panel says, oh, that's it. Marty should do the argument. I will be honest with you, like, as somebody who is in a relationship with another excellent lawyer and feels some competition, and then there's sort of like the gender dynamics, that is a part of the movie that I feel the most. When she's like, this is my issue. I am the one who has worked it up. And the second I stumble in the slightest, the people who are supposed to be on my team want to hand it to my husband. And Marty's like, you could see the look on, you know, Armie Hammer's face playing Marty, like his eyes widen and he's like, oh, I'm going to get in so much trouble here. Like, I don't want to take this argument away from her. Is she going to be mad at me that because I gave her advice, it caused people to take it away from her? Like, I thought that was a really well done piece of the film about the complexities of being in a partnership and trying to maintain that balance of being in a partnership, especially if the outside world is prepared to give one of the partners more credit and more opportunity than the other one.
Which is actually why I love this film, is because of the supported nature that he understands, number one, how good she is and that she's capable of this and is completely supportive of this. I think it was well done. And you know, normally to create drama in most legal movies where there's two lawyers who are sort of in a relationship, they have to be at odds with each other before they do anything. And I never felt like Marty and Ruth were at odds at each other. I felt that they were completely supportive through their entire relationship.
The other thing that popped out when we watched On the Basis of Sex that I had not remembered is the scene where there is an argument about Atticus Finch. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg is telling her daughter that she thinks that Atticus Finch was a terrible lawyer.
I mean, we're going to have a little bit of Atticus going through this entire podcast. To Kill a Mockingbird is one of those movies that everybody knows, and they either think that, and the book is one that everybody knows and probably studied in high school, but is either loved or hated by people for different reasons. And the love is deep. I mean, the love is deep among people, and that is why I think there's such a pushback against it.
This brings us to movie number two, To Kill a Mockingbird, released in 1962 with an Oscar-winning performance by Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch.
It's been described as one of the touchstones in the civil rights movement, which will, as we're going to discuss, create some problems. But Gregory Peck plays the sort of, there's a now a statue of him in Alabama outside the state Supreme Court.
There's a statue of the fictional Atticus Finch who lost the case and his client got murdered before he could do the appeal and but, he covered up a killing?
So I think we're getting ahead of ourselves, but yes, the story of this is from the child's point of view of an attorney, Atticus Finch, who gets asked to represent an African-American man who's been accused of raping a white woman. And so he does the trial, which makes it clear that the African-American Tom Robinson did not actually commit the rape, and although he still gets convicted of that crime. And, you know, Atticus Finch is sort of the ultimate, if you need to know somebody, you need to walk in their shoes type of lawyer who's a gentleman, but is wants to understand those around him. The pro bono aspect, opposed to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who went out to Denver and said, I'm willing to do this for free because this helps my vision of how to change the law, is actually Judge Taylor in this case comes over and sits on Atticus's porch and says, I have this case coming in and I need somebody who is capable of handling it. Will you handle it? And he says, yes. And in a later conversation, he says, I wouldn't be able to hold my head up high in this community if I had said no. And so that's basically the story. And the reason they say it's start of the civil rights movement is because people who didn't understand racism, which, again, who was that? I'm not sure who that was. But people who had a hard time understanding racism and its implications all of a sudden saw somebody, it was noble to stand up against racism. I've been appointed by a judge to do cases. It's sort of your obligation as an attorney when you're appointed to do those cases to the best of your ability. And this is an example of Atticus actually doing a case to the best of his ability.
Could we just pause for a minute and talk about how that the judge coming over to your porch and saying, you know, will you take this case, which is basically something you have to say yes to. I think when I was a city lawyer, I was like, well, that's some weird old timey movie thing. And then we moved to Vermont, right? And you were a lawyer in a small firm in Vermont. I was a lawyer in a small firm in Vermont. And that was still happening in the 90s. You get right. A phone call from a judge and said, I have handpicked you to take this case, right?
So when I was in Vermont, I had come from legal aid and I got a call and the probate judge said, do you know anything about doing adoption or custody cases? And I said, I do. And he goes, well, I heard you worked with mentally ill people. And I said, I did. And he said, I'm appointing you to represent the who doesn't have represent. So we're going to have a case. And then like literally a half an hour later, I got a call from the other attorney who's representing a couple who are trying to adopt a child. Her father, who had been had primary custody of her, was going to jail for a very long time. So she was going to be adopted by his brother, the father's brother, and his wife. And so that is all the information I had. I went out and visited Mom, and Mom says, I have bipolar, it's really bad, so I'm on medication and I have to be very structured, but part of my structure is seeing my daughter every Saturday for the afternoon. I have her from 12 until 5, we go out to lunch, we go to the park, we do things, she comes home with me. I don't want to lose that. And she goes, will I lose that? And I told her, if they adopt her, it's going to be completely up to them whether you ever see your daughter again. And she said, I don't want that. And so My issue was that if you have a relationship with a child, she didn't want to petition for custody. She was clear with it. She's like, I can't handle it. I'm not going to be able to do that. It's not going to work for me. I want what I have, which is a relationship with my daughter where we do stuff together. I want that to continue. And so they had set this up in court that they were going to terminate her parental rights. And, I started asking about, can we maintain a visitation arrangement? It wasn't allowed in Vermont. Can we do anything to be able to make sure that she stays in their life? And they said, we're not going to guarantee anything because any of those guarantees would not be legal under the law. So I decided that I would fight, that they would not. There's other structures besides adoption that could be done, but they had filed an adoption petition. So I ended up writing a 20-page brief as why this didn't actually satisfy the requirements. And there was a GAL report that said that she should be terminated. And I attacked the guardian ad litem for going beyond the scope of what they should have done in the report. And I ended up winning and having the adoption thrown out. And the question was, what do you do then, right? Because you now have not an adoption. So I had been pressing for guardianship only because she'd still have visitation rights. And they didn't want to do that because they wanted to raise somebody who was their own daughter. And after I started reading the Adoption Act, I saw this other act right next to it, which was the Gay and Lesbian Adoption Act.
Vermont wrote it to facilitate same-sex couples being able to do an adoption without terminating the biological parent.
So we ended up doing that instead, although the judge is like, I don't understand. Is there something I'm missing here? Meaning,
somebody gay?
Right. Or is there a relationship that I don't know about, basically? And I was like, no. And it didn't define who could take part in this act anywhere in it. And so the probate judge actually allowed it. And the best comment that happened is the opposing attorney came up to me afterwards and he said, you were supposed to give due process. You weren't supposed to win.
Makes me think of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
That was what was going on. That the judge, you don't get a whole lot of time with the judge, but you don't get the sense that the judge appointed Atticus Finch because the judge thought a great injustice was being done here. He appointed Atticus Finch because he was a gentleman and because he was respected in town and because it was going to be a mess. And so he wanted somebody to keep the temperature down. But
wow,
he
that is
never
a,
expected him to win. And he didn't.
That is such a harsh opinion of what happened in that case. Yes. So I think you're wrong. I think he appointed because he knew Atticus would give the ultimate defense of Tom Robinson, that he would give everything he could, that he would be able to do this. So Atticus talks about in the case, again, Atticus is a fictional character, but Atticus talks about in the case that he was going to, that he believed in the town and that the town could understand how this was an injustice. And part of the defeat of Atticus is that he was not right about his community at the end. But what he tells Tom Robinson at the end, which is, we're going to take an appeal. I'm going to appeal this. And then when Tom Robinson dies, when he's shot because he's running away, because he doesn't trust the system that he will actually get out, Atticus' statement was, we had such a good appeal, we could have won on appeal. And I think this goes into our next movie, which is Just Mercy.
Movie number three, Just Mercy. It was released in 2019 and starred Michael B. Jordan as the real-life lawyer Brian Stevenson. And it was also entirely snubbed by the Academy Awards.
Just Mercy is Michael B. Jordan playing Brian Stevenson, who goes down to Alabama, and he's going to represent capital defendants, people who have committed murder who are on death row. And he is going to start that. And one of his first cases is a guy named Walter McMillan. And so the interesting part about this is that, number one, this is our case that we bended a little because it sort of flows in from To Kill a Mockingbird. He started the Equal Justice Initiative. And so he's not doing this pro bono. He's doing this as for free because he got federal money.
Yes, arguably not pro bono, but it's unclear if he's getting paid much of anything for his own living expenses. Our decision to bend the rules on pro bono, that stemmed from a disturbing but not entirely surprising pattern that we discovered. The movies that lift up pro bono lawyers are almost exclusively about white lawyers. And that just wasn't okay with us. And it's not an honest reflection of who is out there lawyering for the public good in the world. And honestly, after watching the movie, it's not clear if Bryan Stevenson actually was getting any income for himself in the early days of the Equal Justice Initiative. He is sleeping on the couch of a colleague and driving a car that looks like it will drop its transmission at any moment.
The interesting part about this movie is that it's sort of the juxtaposition to Kill a Mockingbird, because it happens in the same place that fictionally To Kill a Mockingbird occurred in.
Right. It's the town that Harper Lee is from.
Right.
Is where Walter McMillan was convicted.
Right.
Of
so,
murder that he didn't commit.
When he goes to the courthouse, they tell him, oh, you're an attorney. You should go see the Mockingbird Museum, when he's actually represented a man who slept with a white woman but got convicted of a crime against a white girl in this town. And sort of like the racism is still there. It's still permeated. And the idea that sort of the fictional character Atticus Finch ended racism in the South, especially towards African-American men, is clearly a theme of this movie. But I would also remind you that, since we just saw the movie, that Bryan Stevenson has a motion in which he has unbelievable amount of evidence showing that Mr. McMillan did not commit the murder that he was accused of, and he lost.
That's true. That's true.
And he actually gets to do the appeal, and I'm not even clear that he would have won the appeal based on what we saw in the movie if it hadn't been 60 Minutes coming out and actually interviewing all the characters and showing to the entire country that this injustice was going on. This is a great movie. I want to make it clear that Michael B. Jordan, you and I have a different opinion of Michael B. Jordan. I think Michael B. Jordan's role in this is unbelievably good.
Do not make it sound like I am not a fan of Michael B. Jordan, because I even watched Creed because Michael B. Jordan was in it, and I could care less about your boxing movies. But I have met Bryan Stevenson, and I went into this film like so excited to see the kind of the genius and the magnetism and the humanity that I have experienced being in the same room as Bryan Stevenson on the screen with one of my favorite actors. And I walked out let down, because I actually thought that Michael B. Jordan, the actor on film, could not match the magnetism of the real Bryan Stevenson, which I think just is me saying, I think the real Bryan Stevenson is the guy whose statue should be in front of the Alabama's court rather than the fictional Atticus Finch.
I thought that Michael B. Jordan was unbelievable in this role. You know, I've had people go after this movie for other reasons as well. A friend of ours who actually does criminal defense work said that the majority of people he represents are actually have done something bad in their lives, but probably don't deserve death row for what they've done. Mr. McMillan clearly didn't do anything that deserved to be on death row. I thought the movie actually showed that with the character Herb, I think Herb Richardson was his name, who did a bombing that killed somebody and he ended up being executed for that and clearly had inadequate defense and PTSD and all those things. This movie was singing to the choir. I don't believe in the death penalty. This is clearly an anti-death penalty movie, but I thought it was extremely strong. And then, you know, it raises those issues about To Kill a Mockingbird that you always have, which is, is you have an African-American who actually goes into his community and meets with the community. Atticus, you see a scene of him going to the house, but he keeps his kids in the car, so you don't hear anything that happens in the meeting with the clients. So, you know, it's just juxtaposed to this.
It's actually an interesting question, and I don't know the answer how much Just Mercy was trying to juxtapose To Kill a Mockingbird. Because again, To Kill a Mockingbird is fiction, and Just Mercy is a true story about a real lawyer and a real client and the things the lawyer really did. I think the movie probably amps up that juxtaposition a little bit because To Kill a Mockingbird and Atticus Finch is such a looming figure in the U.S., in especially in sort of white people's justice circles. I don't know from Bryan Stevenson's perspective, like how much that was an intentional or would be a frustrating juxtaposition, right? Because the point of the movie is to really stop looking at criminal justice issues through the eyes of the most upstanding white lawyer in town. And can we start looking at it from the perspective of communities? There was a fantastic line where Bryan Stevenson is arguing with the prosecutor about how he should drop the case. And the prosecutor says, "Don't you yell at me. My job here is to keep people safe. They gave me this job to keep them safe." And Bryan Stevenson, Michael B. Jordan, looks at him and says, "Who is it that you think you're keeping safe? Who do you mean when you say safe? Because I am working with an entire community of people who are just sort of anxiously awaiting the day that they get falsely accused and convicted of something they didn't do. There is nothing you're doing that makes them feel safe." And I thought that was a sort of a really phenomenal moment in the film. And I think it's a great movie. I think it actually displays what can be difficult about making a movie. And I have no skill in screenwriting. But when they try to make films where the story, where much of the story is actually in the head of the lead character, what is the lead character thinking? How is the lead character reacting? How do you put that on film? And so I actually think that's what's hard, was the challenge in Just Mercy, is I have seen Bryan Stevenson speak and he tells you what he was thinking, right? Yeah. He says, "As the prison guard told me, the lawyer, that I had to be strip searched, here's what I was thinking." But in the scene, you can't have Michael B. Jordan say those things because it's A, not what happened, and B, things will get 100 times worse if he says what he's thinking. So I think it's a tricky thing for a movie. But I will also say, having, again, let go of my Bryan Stevenson idolatry and watching the film a second time, I think it's an excellent film, 100% snubbed by the Oscars.
100% snubbed. Michael B. Jordan was supposed to be nominated for Best Actor. He was not. He was on the short list. Those scenes that you talked about, they are purely in the eyes and on the body of Michael B. Jordan trying to impart what you just said. And I thought he did it in the film. Again, I haven't experienced Bryan Stevenson like you have. So
again, I don't want to exaggerate. It's not like he and I get lunch, but he was literally only 2 years after the story of Walter McMillan, the story of Just Mercy happened. He was a visiting professor at Michigan Law School. I had already taken criminal procedure, so I couldn't take his class. And then my friend started saying, "You just have to come anyways, because he is such a good speaker and the lectures are so amazing that it's just worth it to be in the room." And so as I was able, I just started going to his class for fun. And so that's where my admiration was born. Probably because, right? Because he's not only a phenomenal lawyer and an advocate for justice, but he's an amazing teacher. And for me, being an amazing teacher is an important thing. Dedicated listeners may remember the episode Justice Delayed, which was about lawyers from the firm Milbank, representing people convicted of long sentences, including the wrongful conviction of Mark Purnell in Delaware. When I interviewed Alan Stone for that episode, he told me he got interested in this kind of pro bono work because Bryan Stevenson spoke to the firm about the criminal justice system. If you want to get a sense of Bryan Stevenson and Michael B. Jordan's experience playing him in the movie, check out the clip from Ellen DeGeneres' 2020 interview with the two of them together. Okay, back to the movies. Thank you. Movie number 4. My Cousin Vinny, released in 1992 with an Oscar-winning performance by Marissa Tomei, though Joe Pesci plays the pro bono lawyer.
These movies flow into My Cousin Vinny,
yes,
which is also a capital case. And
that's true.
So I think it's our only comedy on our list.
Yes. I don't think you can say Miracle on 34th Street is a comedy. So I'm going to say My Cousin Vinny is our only comedy.
No, you already said Miracle on 34th Street is a court procedural.
This is true. And I stand by it.
My Cousin Vinny is with Joe Pesci as Vinny Gambini, who gets called. This is like an unbelievable movie because the Karate Kid, Ralph Macchio, is driving with some other guy we don't know the name of. I don't remember his name.
No, me.
I know Ralph Macchio is from New York, and they're going to a convenience store down there. And soon afterwards, the clerk gets killed and they get stopped and arrested.
When I rewatched My Cousin Vinny in the last couple of years, that was a weird moment where I was like, wait, I always thought of this as just this rollicking, funny movie. But within the first 5 minutes, there's a murder.
Yes, there's a huge murder of somebody in the first 5 minutes, and then it becomes a rollicking comedy.
Which is, that's a tonal shift that's tricky to navigate in a film.
And so this movie is about Joe Pesci, the cousin Vinny. The pro bono part is that they have no money, meaning his cousin, the Karate Kid, has no money. So they call up his cousin Vinny, who just passed the bar in New York, to represent them in Mississippi? Is it Georgia? Okay, in Georgia.
We're going to have to double check.
To represent him, and he comes down there with Marisa Tomei playing Mona Lisa Vito down to the South to represent him in the murder trial. And so the pro bono part about this is, like, there's a bunch of movies where family members represent other family members for no money, and this is probably the best. This movie is used in law schools. I have used this movie teaching.
I have used this movie to teach.
Because Vinny does cross-examination and expert witness examination better than any lawyer could teaching it. It is
It's so true.
It is so good. I mean, everything about doing cross-examination based on a person's ability to see where they were, the vantage point, and going through using pictures to, and it's just not us. We're not weirdos because we do it. Like the Seventh Circuit has used this movie as examples. So it's a fantastic movie based on the legal procedural part of it, which is both entertaining and unbelievably good. And him qualifying Mona Lisa Vito, you know, Marissa Tomei, as an expert in car mechanics is unbelievably fantastic and follows the law on how you would do that. And so it is so fun.
It's beautiful example. Also, my favorite line is when, because she is Vinny's fiance and they are in an argument, I think because he did something, he called her not smart or put her down. And so they're in a fight. He gets this brilliant idea to call her to the stand because he's realized something about the tire tracks. He calls her to the stand. She doesn't know what's going on. She is mad and she won't answer his questions. And so Vinny says permission to treat her as a hostile witness. Another procedural thing I've never seen in any other film.
Right.
Permission to treat her as a hostile witness. And she says, oh, you think I'm hostile now? Wait till we get home.
Yeah, no, it is a fantastic movie.
I just looked it up, and while it was filmed in Georgia, it takes place in Alabama, which means a full 50% of our chosen films take place in Alabama.
There
and I'm not sure what that says.
Except that I was completely wrong about Mississippi.
100%, yes.
Yeah.
Say that again. You were what?
100% wrong about Mississippi.
Thank you. I'm going to put that on a loop. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'll take that. So my one issue with this movie is that there's a scene in which Vinny at the beginning decides to take no questions, and it looks like the prosecutor is scoring points. He actually has some theory behind this that we learn later, but he gets fired by Ralph Macchio's friend, and they bring in the public defender. The public defender has a disability, meaning that he stutters and is unable to ask a question. And so I don't know why they had to do that. It's not really that funny. And the disability issue is just sort of terrible and takes away my enjoyment of that scene. You could have made Vinny be able to be better than somebody without having to have him be a person with a disability who's unable to speak in court.
Right. It seems like a lazy way to try to, set up the issue of people not getting competent representation when it's court appointed. Although, now that our son is a paralegal at the public defender's office, it is also frustrating to see the assumption that when people get a public defender, that you should not believe that that's a good lawyer. Like that's a frustrating trope that you see in films all the time. I mean, My Cousin Vinny's interesting. I do think it rides a lot of lines. It's pretty over the top about Southerners.
Yeah.
But it's also, I read an interesting review that said basically everybody's a stereotype. Like it's over the top about New Yorkers.
Yeah.
For sure, Marissa Tomei and Joe Pesci are stereotypes of New Yorkers, outer borough New Yorkers. And the Southerners are stereotypes of Southerners. And the public defender is a stereotype of a public defender. So it raises a complicated question of if every single person in the film is being stereotyped, does that somehow balance it out? I'm not sure. Right. At the end of the day, it survives as still being an excellent teaching tool and pretty funny.
Yeah, I think it's a great film.
Movie number 5 is I Am Sam. Released in 2001 and with an Oscar-nominated performance by Sean Penn.
So the disability issue reads us into I Am Sam. Sean Penn plays Sam in this, Sam Dawson. He is a father with a disability. He has an intellectual disability. This is probably the most pure pro bono movie that we have.
Pure, or is it just the most typical perception of pro bono, that somebody who is a wealthy lawyer at a firm takes a case for free, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to for a family member, or because you're trying to change the world, or because a judge calls you. This is the one that is the more typical. Theoretically, yeah. The more typical setup, although we'll talk about why I don't actually think it's a very accurate reflection of why lawyers and firms do pro bono.
So the setup is that Sam has a daughter. He had a woman living with him and he got her pregnant. And as soon as she gives birth, she is gone. So he has an intellectual disability. He is raising this girl. And at 7 years old, she is now, according to the movie, intellectually beyond where he is. And so he gets into some scrapes that bring the Department of Children and Family Services to his door, and they decide because of his intellectual disability that he should no longer have custody and that he needs an attorney. There is then a trial in juvenile court where he's represented by an attorney played by Michelle Pfeiffer. So here's my deal with this movie is that it came out, it was an Oscar-nominated movie, so I saw it. I had heard about this movie when I was working at Equip for Equality because they had two actors in it who were people with intellectual disabilities who played two of Sam's friends. Everybody was looking forward to this movie, and then the end product, people were sort of like, this is not a great movie. And my issue with this movie is that I was doing custody cases for people with intellectual disabilities and for people with mental illness. And there's no depictions of this in film, right? So seeing the movie again and having seen that movie 23 years ago, I am amazed at how part of it is there's a really young Dakota Fanning playing his daughter who's just right. Adorable. And the movie spends time with them together, of them actually having fun and loving each other for a lot of screen time in the beginning. And it was purposeful, and I think it works that it makes it like the whole idea. The theme behind the movie is that sort of a village raises the child, which is Sam has his friends who also have intellectual disabilities, including these two great actors. And Brad Silverman, I think, is the one actor who had like all the laugh lines in this movie, who was sort of this great guy doing these lines. A lot of people complained about Sean Penn's acting on this. I didn't,
even though that's what was nominated for an Oscar.
And that was nominated for an Oscar, that he was over the top. There's a lot of issues regarding trying to equate him with a 7-year-old or like doing age equivalent. He's the age equivalent of a 7-year-old, both in court. And so the courts have stopped doing that. But I still had issues in court, like, when is he going to get cured? You know, my clients, when are they going to get cured? When are they not going to be disabled? And we would talk about supports that people have in order to be able to parent. And when we were seeing this movie, there was like, how is he going to teach her algebra or how to do, you know, all this stuff that was clearly beyond him, when I was like, we should be looking at health and safety of the child rather than this whole idea that he's not going to be able to teach her or read to her or any of these other things.
As we sit here being unable to help our daughter with her high school math homework, I was like, is that a standard that you have to be able to understand all their homework?
I was so sure that health and safety was it. I actually looked back at the Illinois statute because I was like, what are the actual standards? Because I wanted to say, hey, I know what the actual standards are. They're this. And I look back and they're nebulous. They're like the ability to parent.
Right.
So it makes it really hard, especially for people with disabilities. And to have this movie out there, which sort of showed like the most important thing was love. And there's a scene, Laura Dern is in this movie as the foster.
Okay, can we just for a second talk about what a time capsule this film is for all the actors that are in it? It has the actress who plays the mom and Mrs. Maisel. It has Toby from The West Wing. It has Laura Dern, Dakota Fanning.
Deanne Wiest.
It was a wild film to watch because all these people who have, you know, continued to have really interesting careers kept popping up in small roles. And it's a perfect candidate for that game you taught me where you say to a friend, you know, name a movie that has these three actors in it. And so in our house, we're such movie nuts that we're always watching films trying to see some bit character who's now famous so we can stump someone else with this question, name a movie with these three actors. And this one is just rich on that front.
You know, Rosalind Chow is in this?
That's right. Rosalind Chow is in it. Anyways, that's neither here nor there on the pro bono and the sort of, parents with disabilities front. But that's a fun fact.
So Michelle Pfeiffer gets hired because he and his friends, his intellectual disabled friends are looking through a telephone book when they had telephone books and found the largest ad. And he walks into her office and says, I need a lawyer. And she is currently dressing down her assistant and everybody else. And he comes back because she says she's going to get a friend to him and she doesn't want to look bad in front of her friends and said, I'll do this pro bono for you.
But she does it because her friends are making fun of her.
Yeah.
Because they're
being a terrible person.
Yes, exactly. And she's a terrible person. And so she gets so embarrassed that she says she'll take his case pro bono in front of her friend so that she'll look better, which is a terrible reason to take someone else's life into your hands through a pro bono case. But she does it.
Although I agree with that. She does do it. She does take the case seriously, which I liked.
That's true.
There seemed to be more discovery in this case, meaning that she knew things about people, more things about people on cross-examination than any other attorney would ever know. So
that's true.
I had a case once where they appointed a social worker and I was like, let's look at what is required to parent this child and see if my client can do that. And so I got down and said to the social worker, give me what you as a social worker believe my client should have to do. And when she would say something like, oh, he needs to get a job or she needs to get a job, I was like, that's not required to be a parent. And so we got a realistic list. And so my client worked on that list and was able to do all those things. And what I didn't realize until she told me after the case, that she was actually assigned to the case in order to be somebody to stand up to me and make sure that my client would be terminated rather than be successful. And I had actually convinced her that my client was a good parent. So I thought this movie was good about having somebody. Laura Dern plays this character as the foster mother who wants Sam nowhere near this child. And he convinces her at the end that he is an appropriate parent as part of the parenting team, I will say, of this child. And so I thought that was good. The issue has always been not having somebody with a disability represent somebody in the community and whether that's okay. And I was trying to figure out what that movie was the other night. It's called Peanut Butter Falcon. So Peanut Butter Falcon is about a guy with Down syndrome who got put into a group home, and he escapes and he ends up sort of doing a cross-country adventure with Shia LaBeouf. And they, you know, they have sort of this Huck Finn thing. They take a raft down a stream. They meet Dakota Johnson. And so the Zach Gottsagen, he went to the Oscars with Shia LaBeouf that year and actually presented. So that movie is great because it has a person with a disability who is the lead, and it is really engaging. So I think that's the ideal, is to have somebody from the community actually represent. I Am Sam has been mocked in other movies. In Tropic Thunder, there's the whole idea that this was Oscar bait, and Ben Stiller actually started making fun of people who are playing people with disabilities to get an Oscar nomination, like Sean Penn did in this. And so that movie totally skewers I Am Sam. But I Am Sam, it has warts.
Have warts, but also eminently watchable.
Eminently watchable, as long as you recognize what those things are. And it represents a real issue, which is about people being able to parent their own kids.
Yeah. I mean, the pro bono element of it, she has no boundaries.
She has absolutely no boundaries.
And so that's not sustainable or particularly smart. And the other thing it does is it makes it seem as if it's a little bit that noblesse oblige. So whereas Atticus Finch is like, I am the pillar of my community, and so part of continuing to be the pillar is to do this case. This is a case where her life is a mess, and it is portrayed in the film as if sort of doing this case causes her to find her humanity, and then, you know, her life becomes wonderful, which includes, you know, being less devoted to her career. So, like, there's some complicated messages about where pro bono fits in your life and, you know, what it should be and maybe some of what it shouldn't be. And so I certainly would never use I Am Sam as this is how you want to think about your pro bono. But it is an instructive movie about Hollywood ideas about lawyers and pro bono. That lawyers are basically hollow, empty people. But if they connect with somebody who has humanity, then they might become human themselves.
Yeah, I agree that it's an amped up version. You know, as a podcast listener to you, I have heard some of your interviews talking about people about how meaningful their pro bono was to them. And this is just like that to the nth degree of somebody who's like, they made somebody not a very good person who gets better because of her representation and with a bunch of stereotypes that we're trying to get away from.
Right. And finally, we arrive at movie number 6, Miracle on 34th Street, released in 1947 with the Oscar-winning performance by Edmund Gwenn as Kris Kringle, also known as Santa Claus.
So I do a lot of mental health work, as I said, from the beginning. And, you know, my biggest issue is actually a movie. My biggest problem is that the number one case regarding mental health work is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which came out in 1975 and is about electroconvulsive therapy, which is shown in the movie and is shown as both being very invasive and very painful for the person and not, frankly, effective in that movie. It's based on a 1960 book. It won an Oscar for best movie that year. Jack Nicholson is fantastic in that movie. And as late as last year, which was 2023, I'm still explaining when I appear in court that ECT is not like that, that the science is not like that, that they don't do ECT like that, but it has so permeated the cultural understanding of what's going on that I'm having to explain and having my doctors explain how that movie is incorrect. So it's sort of the effect of movie. So as a counterpoint to that, my movie is Miracle on 34th Street. Miracle on 34th Street is a Christmas movie. So it's about Kris Kringle, who goes to work for Macy's and is as Santa Claus. And there's a divorcee played by Maureen O'Hara, who doesn't believe in anything anymore. And her neighbor, who's played by John Payne, he plays a guy named Fred Gailey, who's an attorney, who is meeting with Natalie Wood, who plays her daughter, in this movie. And Kris Kringle ends up having to go to mental health court. And that happens because he has a psychiatric exam because he keeps saying that he really is Santa Claus. And so he gets sent to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist actually goads him into hitting him. Kris Kringle, played by Edwin Gwenn, who won an Oscar for this portrayal, actually hits the psychiatrist with his cane and gets brought to Bellevue and then flunks his capacity exam at Bellevue Hospital in New York. And so that starts our pro bono issue, which is the neighbor, Fred Gailey, says, I will represent him at his hearing. And so he comes in and says that he wants to have a hearing in front of the judge in mental health court to determine whether he should, as Kris Kringle says, where am I going to live? So the judge, in one of the questions during the cross-examination, he asks him, where are you going to live? And Kris Kringle answers, isn't that what this hearing is to decide? So it's sort of like the perfect setup for this. Now, Fred Gailey decides to represent and never asks for a fee. His firm actually is opposed to him representing because it's not an appropriate case for the firm. So Fred Gailey represents him. And the interesting part about this movie is two things happen that is consistent. One, the judge warns him. He's like, you don't have to actually testify on your behalf. And Edwin Gwenn, playing Kris Kringle, actually says, no, I'm willing to do this. And then they go through a cross-examination of him, which is not inconsistent with how you would have a cross-examination and a direct examination in mental health court. And there's even a little bit of backroom judge thing. It was like, how are you going to rule on this? Now, the result is that Fred Gailey ends up deciding that he has to prove that he's actually Santa Claus in order to win, which is where we get from the actual court into like the make-believe. And Fred Gailey wins because of the little girl played by
Natalie Wood.
Natalie Wood sends a letter to Santa Claus, and the post office delivers it to him.
She addresses it to him
at the North Pole,
where Kris Kringle actually lives, right?
Yeah. At North Pole or whatever.
And no, she gives him a real address, wherever he really lives. And then the post office, there's this great scene in the post office where the guy's processing the mail, and he's like, get a load of this one. We got all these Santa letters to the North Pole, but this one is to, 123 Wall Street, in New York. And then they say, hey, what if we sent them all to that address? Then we'd be able to get rid of them. So they send all the Santa letters, bags and bags and bags of the Santa letters to Kris Kringle, the character who's on trial in mental health court because he says he's Santa.
And Fred Gailey wins the case because he said that the law requires the post office to deliver mail to the actual person or it's a felony, and the post office gave it to my client, which proves that he's Santa Claus. Now, the interesting pro bono thing on this is that the firm on the second day of trial, where he said, I'll prove that they're Santa Claus, said, you're going to have to drop this case or you're not going to be working here anymore. And he tells Doris, the woman who works at Macy's, and she said, well, what did you do? And he said, I quit because representing people who are getting, you know, messed with like Chris here is the only law worth doing. And I'd rather do that on my own than work for a firm and make money. And so he ends up quitting his job and opening his own practice at the end because he found, you know, what he wanted to do. So Fred Gailey is my ultimate in pro bono attorneys.
He's your fictional pro bono attorney hero. That's awesome. The other thing I love about Miracle on 34th Street is it shows the way that, you know, we pretend that law is all about sort of just balls and strikes, to quote the Chief Justice. You have all these back scenes with the judge and the prosecutor being confronted with what it will mean for their own lives and their own reputations in the world to have proved that Santa Claus isn't real and that weighs on them. And so it has, you know, so Fred Daly gives the judge a hook. He has to give the judge a hook. So he uses the post office bit to give the judge a hook, but the judge is more than happy to take the hook because he doesn't want to tell his grandkids that Santa Claus isn't real.
Or the voters,
right?
Yeah, which there's a great scene with sort of his political guy telling him, like, are you really going on the ballot as the guy who said that there was no Santa Claus? So some of these movies are problematic. I don't think Miracle on 34th Street is problematic. People might find I Am Sam a little bit problematic. People may find To Kill a Mockingbird a little bit problematic. I don't think any of them reach the nature of not being worth watchable.
I like your theory, even though I often give you a hard time about it, that we need to see every single thing that's nominated because then we can have an informed opinion. And even if I hate it, I know I hate it, and I know why. Thank you, John. Thank you for doing this with me.
Thank you, Lish.
This was so much fun. I love you. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
I am often asking the question, why do we do pro bono? If you believe the movies, we do it to change the nation or to support a community or to live up to your vision of what it means to be a good person. Sometimes you end up doing it because your family or friend is in need, or you want to prove yourself to the world. And maybe pro bono becomes a vehicle to change your whole life. Or maybe, much like going to the movies, pro bono gives you something interesting to talk about with your loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. And a special thanks to my guest and husband, John Whitcomb of Monahan Law Group, who, by the way, won the pool at our Oscars party. He accurately predicted 20 out of 23 awards. If we missed a pro bono movie that you wish we'd talk about, send an email to pursuingjustice@pli.edu. We will check out your picks, especially if they're Oscar nominated, or you can argue they should have been, and then we'll compile a watch list for next year.
Thanks for listening to Pursuing Justice, The Pro Bono Files, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. This production is dedicated to the pro bono and public interest lawyers working to improve access to justice. A special thanks goes to our producer, Daniel Pinitz, as well as our host, Alicia Aiken. Please note that the views and opinions expressed during this podcast represent those of the individuals being interviewed and not necessarily those of PLI. PLI is a nonprofit learning organization dedicated to keeping attorneys and other professionals at the forefront of knowledge and expertise. For more information about PLI's wide-ranging curriculum of pro bono programs, visit pli.edu/pro bono.